This morning, we had a conversation about dealing with the Menominee's experience with termination. Shirley Bailey, who is with us this evening, gave an address that outlined three policies, you might say, of the federal government. The allotment policy, which had to be assimilation, the relocation policy, which was in line with that same idea, and then termination, which also took it for granted that Indians would be assimilated. This evening, we have with us Ruth Wright, who is from the Indian Studies Department at the University of Minnesota. She is going to speak first, and then we'll hear again from Shirley Bailey. Ruth, I think, is going to speak about treaty rights, Indian claims, something about the ongoing effects of the Peel Hyde Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. And then after that, Shirley will be talking to us about self-determination under the recent Public Law 648. So I think at this point I'll call upon Ruth Wright, and we'll ask her to speak as long as she likes, and then come back to Shirley. Thank you.
Don't let me run too long. And if it prints, you can't see me, let me know. I've been standing still for a couple of days, so the voice is going in and out. So let me know. Also, because of our numbers, I think it's possible for us to do a good deal of discussion and not have to wait for formal question to answer to. So if we could go along, you have questions to the point as we're moving along. Please feel free to raise them, okay? The first thing that I'd like to talk about is treaty and treaty rights in general. I'd like to give you six major elements of treaty, first of all. Treaty has six major elements, the first of which is a treaty is an agreement between two or more sovereign nations. And that word sovereignty becomes extremely important for Indian tribes today, because we might loosely define sovereignty as the right to control your own internal affairs. And treaties were made as binding legal documents between Indian nations and eventually the new United States. Now, the first of the treaties between the United States and the Indian nation came with the Seneca in 1794, something called Pickering Treaty. And the Pickering Treaty, interestingly enough, as all other treaties have been, was broken by the U.S. federal government in 1963 under the Kennedy administration. I meant to say, does anybody happen to know what was put into effect that broke one of the very first treaties signed by George Washington and the Seneca people of the Iroquois League? It seems to have been, Bessie St. Marie has a rather popular song that talks about the Kings of the Band project and the Army Corps of Engineers flooding something like two-thirds of the Seneca Reservation, which was in direct violation of those treaty rights. So sovereignty becomes a very, very important issue today for Indian people concerning those treaty rights. The second major element of a treaty is that it is a compromise between two sovereign nations. Third, it generally involves the Indian people in terms of treaty rights land possessions and defined land rights. Land possessions and defined land rights. Fourth is a binding legal document with the status of constitutional law. Treaty rights today are not some matter of antiquarian interest or some passing whim of morality, nor should they be. A gentleman whose name is probably more familiar to most of you from Watergate and the Watergate film, a man named Sam Irwin. Do you remember that name? Quite vividly from TV, I think. Sam Irwin had a congressional commission headed to define the status of treaties. And he said out of those that treaties is at a par with constitutional law, if not higher, because it's a part of international law. So that the treaty rights of American Indian people, as they are broken throughout the years, present day, and not a matter of antiquarian concern, as you often hear people say, well, these are documents signed 100 years ago, what do they mean? They are a part of your own U.S. constitutional process, and as in a bicentennial year, you regard your constitution, and I think you should regard constitutional law of the U.S., so must you legally regard the treaty rights of American Indian people, because they are on a par, they are a part of that constitutional process. Go back to Article 2, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution and take a look at it. The fifth element of treaty is that it has an element or an agreement of duration. We often see that put down on a stereotypical, as long as the grass will grow, the rivers flow, the sun shines. An element of duration. And last, fifth, was to protect the rights of both parties. Okay? If anybody has any idea how many treaties were signed between the United States and Indian nations? Okay, let's look at it. 371. Now, everybody's familiar. How many have been broken by the U.S. federal government? It's real easy now. 371. Okay? The treaty process itself, I can't impress upon you enough that it is one of the last legal protections of the American Indian land base left, and American Indian people have paid dearly in terms of their land base within treaties. And this is a part of the legal framework of the United States. It is not a passing moral whim. It is part of the legal status of your own U.S. Constitution. In terms of the treaty process was probably in its height around the end of what they call the Plains War, perhaps from about 1854 to 1868. In 1871, Congress, under something called the Appropriations Act, stopped unilaterally the process of making treaties with Indian nations. From that time period on, reservations were established in one of two ways, either by congressional act or by executive or presidential order. Because treaties were stopped by action of Congress in 1871, does that mean, let's say perhaps, treaty signed in 1854 and I put that date because I think there's a man who had a very important treaty in 1854. Does that mean that treaty of 1854 no longer has legal validity in 1976? Okay. The process of stopping treaty making by Congress in 1871 by that Appropriations Act due to major legal validity of treaties for American Indian people. It is still supposedly in theory. It is supposedly as legally effective today as it was in 1854, if one goes by the theory of the law. In terms of practical application today, that is not, however, true. Today you cannot even get a court to rule on the status of cities, and we might talk a little bit about that if you will. But outside of cities, there has been something like over 5,000 different congressional statutes that apply to American Indian people. The Menominee, among others, have been inundated with these congressional laws or statutes. Okay. One of these was something called the Indian Reorganization Act, or the Howard Wheeler Act, named after the senator and a man in the House of Representatives who sponsored the bill. The Howard Wheeler Act, passed in 1934, has several major provisions, and I meant to list them. I'm trying to do this out of my memory because I don't know if I can talk about this. The first provision of the Indian Reorganization Act said that there was to be no more allotment. And I think Henry mentioned that you discussed allotment previously. Allotment was the individualization of American Indian land. And in that individualization, which began in 1887, allotment is always called a badge for variety of American Indian people. When badges were put into effect, had about 140, 150 million acres of land. By the time that the Indian Reorganization Act comes along, several generations later in 1934, Indian people have left only something like one-third of their land base, something like 45 or 50 million acres. So that two-thirds of the land base was lost in allotment. One of the things that IRA did, first division, was to say no more allotment. Allotment was to be reversed with that. The second division was to say that authorized land could be brought back. Underneath that provision of allotment, less than 2% of the land lost in allotment were ever brought back. Okay. The third provision of Howard Wheeler or the Indian Reorganization Act was the establishment of tribal self-government. And I want to go into that in just a minute. The first provision has a long term for Indian education. The fifth, not to go back and read the act, this may not be the exact order of provision. The fifth was a long term for private businesses. We might just give you a kind of a relevant fact that's sort of interesting. The land fund for Indian businesses was started at something like $10,000. Interestingly enough, today, that land fund has the highest return rate in the entire federal government loan system. Any idea what the lowest return rate is? It's kind of interesting. It certainly includes student loans. Okay. The fifth is a 5% capital rate for business purposes. And the seventh, this is not a new one that the Indian Reorganization Act is just to go back to the early 1800s, but there could be Indian settlement and Indian service. And that could mean if Indian and non-Indian are equally qualified for position in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, then the Indian person could receive preference in the Bureau of Service. Okay? What becomes really important, the Indian Reorganization Act is very unique as a piece of legislation, unique in several ways. This was the first piece of legislation for Indian people that was bilateral. And by bilateral, I mean this is the first piece of legislation that even people can vote on. Only 30% of the enrolled members need vote, however, in order to pass IRA, therefore you only need something like 15, a little over 15% of the voting membership to pass it. The second law that was moot was that if you look at the full implementation of the provisions in terms of government, it would have protected the social and religious cultures of Indian people, thereby putting in cultural pluralism, recognizing cultural pluralism for the first time, not this whole melting pot, John Moynihan kind of theory of administration. Okay? And the thing that was unique was that they set up an applied answer to implement that provision on self-government, and so it's the first entrance of social science into the field of human affairs. Whether that's, if that's good, bad, or indifferent, I don't know. But that first provision of self-government becomes really, I think, the structural point that many Indian people today are criticizing. In fact, let's take a look at one case example. Let me take Pine Ridge for an example, because Pine Ridge today, Pine Ridge was the site of Wounded Knee II, the occupation of Wounded Knee. Pine Ridge accepted IRA in 1935. In 1939, some of the tribal elders were already in Washington trying to get IRA repealed. Now the question is why? This is in many respects a very enlightened piece of legislation. So why were they there in 4 years later trying to get IRA repealed? Okay, some of the things that happened, okay, in terms of implementing that third provision, they were supposed to take a look at traditional forms of government and to integrate those in terms of charters and American legalese. Okay? If you take a look at the Pine Ridge Reservation, what happened in terms of Pine Ridge, interestingly enough, the man who worked on Pine Ridge Constitution and the man who was supposed to be the governor expert on Pine Ridge was a man that was sort of appealed. And he also just happened to be the head of the applied answer unit in the Bureau at the time. In 1944, he was given some very, very strong criticism just 10 years later. But okay, the system that was set up in Pine Ridge, first of all, if you just take a look at the structure, and this is not on similar to other reservations across the country, you might have a chairperson. Councilman, secretary, treasurer, vice chairperson, and the voting members of the tribe. Okay, not unfamiliar in terms of a corrupted structure or government coordinator. From the government, you may be more familiar with. It really has the problem. Okay, let's take a look specifically at how we see some of the data. And in terms of complement, Pine Ridge, the district would be headed off arbitrarily. One councilman coming to each 300 people in that district, and one extra building up to 150 people. What it turns out into a town, was the traditional arrangement of self-government on Pine Ridge, which rested upon something in all the court speakers within our conversation, theoretical. So theoretical, we might work with it as the bilateral extended family in its political sense. Okay? When these districts were laid out, it might have several a theoretical and several ways. So it was pretty much a traditional political arrangement, a 1949 that took the old men of going into the world in the place to stay. Look, if it's different culture without traditional form, and you're having a really hard time to get up and take into account the local, where we have almost different companies and cultures, and then in terms of consensus, in terms of a social or very bad structure, rather than perhaps an apex structure. So you're trying to look at traditional form. We've not incorporated as much as or in the manner that we might like them to be. Okay, that's one problem in terms of the implementation of self-government, but settlement here in South 10 years later gives the cases an art. And he was one of the men who worked out the Pioneer's Constitution. If I had it before me, we could read it. And there are various powers. The first is the power to set the boundaries, and that simply sets up the reservation boundaries of Pine Ridge. The second, the power of membership, that's subject to U.S. Code 25. The third sets up the structure of the private council itself, like this that we have on the board. And the fourth delineates all sorts of powers, the Pine Ridge private council is legally empowered to have. And some of them to restrict non-members from the reservation, to hire legal counsel, to incorporate business, to manage private lands, private enterprises, all with one proviso. It almost becomes a thin thing when you read them. And that proviso is all those powers are subject to approval by the Secretary of the Interior. The Secretary of the Interior being represented by the local agency superintendent, by the local area office. Now, one of the criticisms McKeel was in 44, and one of the criticisms that Indian people today are given of this provision concerning self-government is that in many ways it is a fictionalized self-government. If everything has to be approved, and I mean everything has to be approved by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, then what you're dealing with is not true self-government or self-determination, but something that's constantly being imposed upon or intervened upon by the U.S. federal government. In recent years, I think because of many actions coming from the Indian communities themselves, and I'm not just saying this because Sherry Bailey is here, but the Menominee community being one of them, I think there is a lot less of this direct implementation of that approval by the Secretary of the Interior staff as there has been in the past. But that rider is still there in many constitutions across the country. And this is another thing that Indian people are talking about in regard to the Indian Reorganization Act. There are many, many other structural things concerning the implementation of self-government. I want to try to keep my timeline. Let me just say a few words about the Indian Crime Commission. We're getting real quick talk here. And then maybe any questions that you have. The Indian Crime Commission was set up near the South and it was set up in 1946. And the Indian Crime Commission, interestingly enough, was set up for primarily one reason. Congress wanted to get out of the Indian business. This is kind of a backlog to some things we've been talking about, relocation, termination, that whole decade of getting out of the Indian business. I think, too, that the Indian Crime Commission was set up because following human rights cases had gone through the district court system, and in the background of the Indian land claim cases in the district court, But in order to quote, get out of the Indian business, they had to do something about these hundreds and hundreds of long-term cases. So they set up a special quasi judicial body by legislative act, by Congress, the Indian Trans Commission. It is a quasi judicial body. You can appeal out of it all the way up to the Supreme Court if necessary. The Indian Trans Commission hears land and city cases, and it must collapse the time of hearing to three categories. So hear land or city cases that give Indian people inadequate payments for the land, did not pay Indian people at all for the land, or whether the fraud or mismanagement or the breaking out for the services misdemeanors. Okay? These two kinds of cases that they hear involve only money. You can only get remuneration or recompense for land taken with an adequate payment, non-payment, or under the fraud, mismanagement, or broken or short law. You cannot get that for land underneath the Indian Trans Commission system. Okay? Also, just to give you a real idea of how this works, let's just take an example. The state of California, because it becomes a good example already. Let's say there was a treaty in 1848 with one of the California tribes, let's say. And what the court commission does, that tribe, let's say, finds that they were inadequately paid to a land under treaty in 1848. Now, the commission forecast tries to establish the land price at that time. Not now, but that time is pretty final. So let's say the worst thing is 47 cents. And it's established that the land of 1878 is worth $1.47. So what you get is the difference in terms of the land value at that time. Okay? There is no interest payment on that money down to the time. Also, in terms of this arrangement, I trust that some of you may be familiar with William O. Douglas. Back in the 50s, there was something called exclusive use, and that is the two tribes are in the same land area, 5 years, unless there's a transaction grant, the only land that they determine payment on is that land exclusively used by the tribe that brings action. So it's 3 months, and if the case action end up with a land that is here in which nobody can really file suit. Okay? Originally, the lifetime of the Indian Trans Commission, which I told you the whole purpose was to get out of the Indian business, it was set up for a 5-year period. They ended up with 3 so many court cases that they're spending another 5 years, and then another 5 years, and then another. And the Indian Trans Commission, technically, though it's not doing many cases, is still in business today because of this backlog of land and city claims cases. All right? I really want to impress upon you the fact, though, that with the Trans Commission, all you're dealing with is monetary recompense. You're not in any way dealing with what becomes so very important to Indian people today, and that's the consolidation and the development of the land base itself. Because here in the land base, which is why Indian people talk about treaty rights all the time, here in the land base, that treaty was supposedly to protect, utilize the culture, the heritage, the religious identity of Indian people. And that, I don't think, can be over-impressed upon people. that land is all important in terms of Indian people, because it is Indian people. Okay? One thing that we talk, I just kind of gave you a hit and miss in these areas. And why don't we just take questions or discuss some of the things perhaps that we've said, because I think it's leading into what Terry Day is going to talk about tonight, and that is self-determination. Do you have questions or responses? Yeah. I'm sorry, I have stepping in the station, so it's like a really hard time hearing. Passed in 1934, in 39 there was, I think perhaps about 30 of the elder men of Conyers went to Washington to try to repeal a bit from Congress. It was approved in general referendum. Now, the act said that 30% of the enrolled members had to vote, which meant you could pass IRA with 15%, just a little over 15% of the voting membership. Now, that might seem not explained to you in terms of the usual workings of court majority rule in the United States, but seriously, this is the first time you had any kind of input, any kind of voting, in terms of Indian communities and a piece of legislation, which in and of itself, the 15% doesn't look like much. It's a big jump from zero. If you want to take a very clear look at the legal system, most of those 5,000 statutes, I shouldn't say all of them, but 99.4% of them are in violation of treaty law, simply by the manner in which they were passed. They were passed by Congress, okay? Not in agreement between Indian tribes and the United States government, and that's a violation of treaty and treaty contracts. But when you talk about sovereignty, just go back to 1830, really 1828 to 1831, and something called the Marshall Decision. He says this was the same quote during the Jacksonian era, John Marshall, when he series of three decisions, and they really qualified the concept of sovereignty. In a case called Register versus the State of Georgia, in which a missionary to Cherokee country had been buried by the State of Georgia in violation of Cherokee treaty rights. He'd been invited onto the land to establish an educational system that was controlled in terms of curriculum and funding by the Cherokee people. The Cherokee had buried him and had no right to do so, because the Cherokee, in terms of their sovereignty, had the right to deal with the educational system on their land if they wished. The two Cherokee lawyers that took the case up to the Supreme Court, and it got heard before John Marshall. Marshall opposed the sovereignty of Indian people and says that the state of Georgia has no right to interfere in Cherokee law. However, remember the Council of 1830. Are we still a federal U.S. government? We're not that far away from the year of 1812. America still very much depends upon the strength and friendship of Indian nations, and I emphasize that nations. So John Marshall, I use the term kind of jokingly, he accompanied that. He says that American Indian tribes are dependent domestic nations, and what he really wanted out of that was that the could not make treaties with anybody else but the U.S. government. And Ehrlich tried to explain that to kind of domestic nations. He used an analogy. He said that Indian tribes were as a child to its guardian a child to its lord. And we get the concept of worship as part of the government and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That analogy becomes kind of unfortunate because that's what's picked up rather than the threat during the five unity of Indian nations. Because his qualification, I think if I'm reading him right, was meant to be that you could not make treaties with other colors. And looking at the contours, that is important to the United States government. But what gets picked up is that a concept legally defined or ill-defined as worship, as is causing severe problems in terms of the concept of sovereignty, as it should, is legal in terms of truth. Anything. In terms of land and city rights, I think one of the problems that we have in terms of getting a court to rule on the status of city rights, and if any of you followed the Linda New trial here in St. Paul, you know that Judge Nichols, the city of New avoided the status of cities. He put it in only as motivational evidence and had a jury out at the time, and you had 15 minutes to tell him what the set law in the city of 68 was, and you can't read the provisions in 15 minutes. The big problem, I think, is our court systems are not immune to political pressure. And one of the big bugaboos, I think, that almost becomes a boomerang on the people is when you begin to talk about land and city rights of Indian people. You take a look at this country, you take a look at a map of how land successions work, and the huge section of this country, many of them taken with inadequate payment or without payment even. You begin to look at those land sections, and American people become very worried about what happens to the land that I am on. Okay? I think it's unrealistic to say everybody's going to pack up a suitcase and get back on a boat. I don't think that's the stance of Indian people. If you take a look at some of the lands Indian people are talking about, take a look at maps of some reservations. Some of them up here in the state of Minnesota. You'll see national park areas, U.S. governmental lands, federal lands of different kinds. I think these are negotiable points in terms of protection of land based with Indian people. And even in terms of individual title, you have negotiable items. Indian people are certainly traditionally, listen to some of the old people talk. The things that you do is always very important. Hospitality and sharing are very important items of traditional cultural talent. Indian people are not saying realistically that we're going to have you practice your cases and leave. They're saying that Indian lands need to be protected as a land base, because this is so much what Indian people are, past, present, and future. And it is so important in terms of Indian culture and Indian religion, what Indian people are, that the bogeyman of what happens to quote American land, I think really is that, just the bogeyman. I think it's a factor of American people not knowing what city rights are, what lands are ours, and all the traditional practices and rites of Indian people. Think of a good song, it's a matter of cultural ignorance. Indian land today can be held in a number of ways. Indian land can be held in terms of what's called the trust arrangement, the beneficial title is held by the U.S. government, the ultimate title is held by the U.S. government, the beneficial title is held by Indian people themselves. That trust arrangement can be both tribal and individual, coming from the time period of allotment, so that you have several patterns overlaid on one another of how land can be held. First you have reservations could be established by treaties, congressional acts, or executive orders. Then land can be held tribally, and that can be in fact an outright title in itself. Okay? Land can be held individually in what they call fee patents, so that's an individual title, buy and sell is totally up to the individual. This is put in another American citizen. And the third way is what they call fee patent. And if you want a really strange situation, and many Indian people are in this, a fee patent is you hold the land individually just like fee simple. But in fee patent, first the government granted you that land. So in essence, the government is granting you back your own land. Okay. So that's kind of six combinations of a way reservation land can be held. Okay. You can have different kinds of permutations of it. Okay, there are some very different examples. Let me just give you one. Winnebago Reservation in Wisconsin. Originally, much of that land was picked up under homestead. Winnebago people who avoided removal to Nebraska. And underneath that homestead act, Winnebago people individually picked up sections of land. Part of those sections were put into tribal common property, and around the outside was, you know, the individual section. So you have some different kinds of arrangements across the country. Okay. You use the word chief, and up here, I would figure to do my translation. The word for leader, I think, is ogamot. Okay. A leader is not the chief in the sense that Europeans are first looking for in a treaty process. But in terms of consensual democracy, which is very much the pattern of many tribes, leaders are followed only as they show their qualities of leadership. Okay? So that one good example is the Settler in the Treaty of 1868. Supposedly within that treaty with the Lakota people and some others, it was supposed to be changed only by two-fourths referendum vote of all males within the society. But the whole leadership pattern is much different horizontally than it is in terms of American majority and a president or a king system. So, just to call another example at random, the Navajo Treaty, 1868, several treaties before that, the government just got extremely upset because they signed with different bands of the Navajo, the Dene, and the other bands didn't follow it. And the government kept saying all these nasty, dirty, ugly Navajo people, and they don't live up to their treaty then. And the fact was they were signing with one band or maybe at most two bands, which didn't encompass even a majority of Navajo society. And the only ones who felt obligated to go by those treaty provisions were those specific bands. that was a man knowledge of the political system within the people. Land was not part of the market. Land was not a viable, sellable commodity. I sometimes use that bad analogy of oil for American people, but now you can buy the canisters and hold it, so it's getting to be a really bad analogy. But it wasn't and isn't a commodity of the American market. And maybe because of the time, I think when we set this up structurally, you're right, you do emphasize almost the kind of logic of it, and you end up with the question, well, why is it different? It looks so logical just laid out there. I think what we miss is what Indian people and tribes are doing today in their own community. And I think it's really, really valuable to have someone like Shirley Bailey do the task to that what Indian people are doing in time. Against all this, it seems at many times devastating and both frustrating. But what Indian people are doing in light of that, I think is almost amazing. I think maybe we ought to get onto the place and talk about that.
I've never said a little bit this morning, but I want to say again that she is the vice chairperson of the Nominee Restoration Committee. She was a charter member of them and served as its director from 1971 to 1972. Jen being an organization which was vitally interested in dealing with the problem of tsunami land loss. And she also was a member of the legislative committee which lobbied for the restoration of the tsunami reservation, which was accomplished in December of 1972. So we'll hear from Shirley Bailey this time.
I'm not really aware of how many people here tonight were with us this morning, but in talking about the subject that I wanted to get onto, and just a little bit of background and things that we've done here would be helpful to give you some idea following your character education that you became received, and I might remind you that all women, I think it was a very good one, and I feel that I'm going to get away. A little more knowledge than I came here with. I could talk about Menominee's prior determination and how it's just been moved. Prior determination, we had a reservation system that was operated pretty much like the diagram that you see on the board with the chairman and the tribal council and the borders. And Menominee's operated under the tribal council system. The tribal council would meet about four times a year to decide on policies that they wanted, the deals of the budget. And that kind of thing. The quorum for the general council was 75 people. There was one amendment to our constitution about 1920 somewhere in the area, where we then decided to have a reservation business council. All the reservation had been called reservation business council. All was called an advisory council. This advisory council was a 12-member board, and they took care of business matters in between sessions of the general council. However, the general council could still get together and overrule any decisions made by the advisory council. Whatever decisions were made by the General Council and the Advisory Council were subject to the approval of the Secretary for the Interagency And it seems that Ms. Cooper is more advisory action to the secretary, and the superintendent and the reservation can then determine whether or not he's going to follow those recommendations. The Menominee industry that came out of the lodging industry later on developed into the family. We had several problems in establishing a tribal family. Our lands were covered by the lumber dams back in the early 1800s when it took up the Menominee reservation. We had tried nearly an Indian uprising on the Menominee reservation. Over the problem that the Indians were not allowed to cut their timber, and for nearly a year, people held out fighting against the lumber baron, fighting against the government, so that at some point in time they'd be able again to harvest their timber and work the land in the way that they preferred. So with the establishment of the sawmill, the Menominee tribe was able to manufacture its lumber and to sell it to the outside market. The tribal logging lumbering operations were still managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The management was for the mill was always looking at that as there as a place to employ Indians rather than as a place to make or fill any kind of maximum profit to the resources that the manufacturer. When the Indian Claims Commission came into being, the Menominee decided that they were going to take a seat there to sue the government for mismanagement of the forest. There had been a blowdown on the reservation that was considered by race. There was also charges of mismanagement and no operation. But the Menominee went to the civil to the court of claims and won a lawsuit there. The lawsuit totaled $8.5 million that the tribes recovered them from damages due to mismanagement. The $8.5 added to the money that the Menominee already had in treasury sent to the Menominee tribal fund to $10 million. So it seemed at the time that the Menominee was a fairly wealthy tribe. We were, as a tribe, wealthy as individuals who borderline felt which was a poverty. Menominee education was advancing. Menominee people, the population was increasing, and so the Menominee leadership at the time seemed that we needed to do something with our land industry to expand, to diversify, and other areas that they wanted to go into for reservation economic development. So we had all that money, but we couldn't do anything with it because it was held in the federal treasury. And it took an act of Congress then to get the Menominee money out of there and to be spent in the direction that we wanted to be spent. We had to have a bill introduced in order to get the money out. Part of the money would be for $1,500 per capita payment. The congressman representing the Menominee took the bill to Congress. And while a bill was in Congress, a termination rider was attached to the bill. And that led up to Menominee's termination. All the programs, all the business operations on the reservation were each up managed and operated by Bureau of Indian Affairs employees, with Menominee holding only an advisory role. Termination then became a reality after several years of expansion. It determined then that Menominee, if they had the intelligence to go into court through the federal government and win in the lawsuit, could certainly manage it for themselves. So in 1961, the Menominee were cut adrift, but it was determined after belated studies that Menominee I think meaning that we normally are looking for in the platform that we've run on recently is for normal self-determination. The self-determination using government terms can only go so far. As I stated this morning, it only goes as far as Congress is willing to appropriate funds. So in recognizing that, the kind of self-determination we want is the kind of self-determination where eventually we can be free from the yearly budget worries about how much we're going to get, how much we're going to be cut, what programs we have to let go. So that at some point in time, we feel that our pride is going to be able to